Hey everyone, welcome. This is Eugene here, and today is episode 75 of Forensics Talks. My guest today is Gary Dunn, and he's going to be talking about the David Kam case, and specifically his book, which is Their Bloody Lies and Persecution of David Kam. So Gary Dunn is a 27-year FBI agent with a wide array of experience investigating white-collar corruption, terrorism, and violent crimes. He was the lead private investigator working for David Kam's defense team, and it's probably an understatement to say that, you know, he was stunned by the lack of a fair justice system, just how poorly the investigation was run, bias with forensic experts, and a whole number of different issues that arose during the investigation and the actual trials. Now, he published this book very recently, Their Bloody Lies and Persecution of David Kam, and it says part one under here. So that means I'm going to be expecting a part two. And in fact, the book we can talk about, you know, we will get into detail, but it basically covers like the first and second trials and a number of details that you don't get anywhere else. So the David Kam case is has been featured nationally on Dateline, 48 Hours, the Oxygen Network. There's other smaller things on YouTube that you can find, but none of those will go into the level of detail that you're getting here. Interviews, very specific interviews, a lot of specific questions and answers. And so very, very interesting. Now, of course, I'm probably biased myself because I worked on the David Kam case, but I only worked on it in the third trial. And there were two trials previous that were, I guess they spanned, they went over several years. So when I got into it, I was kind of late to the party, let's say. But nonetheless, I met Gary at that point, and I remember having a lunch after I had testified. And well, let me tell you, it was extremely revealing. And I don't know if I believed him, everything he was telling me, but sure enough, when you get into the details, a lot of this was extremely true. Now, also, I should bring up the fact that I interviewed David Kam himself on the Forensics Talks program, and that was episode 13. And so you could find that on YouTube if you want some information. But of course, you know, even David Kam himself, you know, he wasn't on the outside. He was in prison. And so as a result, you know, getting Gary's perspective on this, I think, is going to be really important. So I will say this before we begin, and that is that, of course, you know, a lot of the comments and topics that are discussed here are based on Gary's research, his involvement in the David Kam case, and, you know, working with others who he interacted with, you know, both on the prosecution and defense side. So leave it at that. And let me bring him in here. And there he is. Hey, Gary, how you doing?
Hey, great, Eugene. Thanks for having me.
Oh, a pleasure. And thank you so much for being here and sharing this. We're totally going to get into the book here in a second, but I want to begin with you, and I want to ask you about your past life with the FBI, which was a fairly lengthy career. Now, were you doing other stuff before the FBI, or how'd you get into the FBI?
Oh yeah, after I graduated from Indiana University with a degree in secondary education, I never utilized that because immediately after graduation, I enlisted in the United States Navy. I spent 5 years as a naval officer. Subsequently, got out of the Navy and went to law school for a brief period of time, and then my application to the FBI was accepted. And so I went to the FBI in 1976. My time there was spent first in Miami, Florida, then several years in Chicago, Northwest Indiana, Gary, Indiana, the resident agency there, and then finally in Southern Indiana. And I have to say, and this is important to me, I was in Indiana for 18 years, and I worked very, very closely with the Indiana State Police. And wonderful organization. The people with whom I worked were sheer professionals. And I have to say that because what I learned and saw and experienced in David's case involving the state police was just the opposite. And it was shocking, certainly for a person with my experience and relationship with the state police.
Yeah, for sure. What kind of cases or what kinds of things were you assigned to during your career with the FBI?
Oh, it was wonderful because I was fortunate enough to be in a position to work with wonderful other men and women, great investigators in Chicago. I was undercover for a year with a major corruption investigation involving both Chicago and New York City. Northwest Indiana, did a lot of property crimes, arson for profit. Had one case in Chicago, an arson case that went to the Supreme Court and was upheld. Our conviction was upheld 9-0. Rare that you get a unanimous decision on the Supreme Court, but we did. And then did a lot of property crimes. Worked with a wonderful friend, colleague, John Novoselov with the Hammond Police Department, who was assigned to the FBI in Gary. We worked a lot of arson for profit, property crimes, car, organized chop shops. And then, of course, in southern Indiana, worked a lot of, unfortunately, kidnapping, murder, a lot of violent crime. And, of course, along the way, a lot of back when the FBI was working, a lot of bank robberies, did a lot of that. I was very fortunate. I had a lot of great experience with a lot of wonderful men and women over the years.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is, of course, you had retired. And like, so how much time had elapsed when you retired? Were you thinking you were going to go private? Were you like, yeah, I'm going to take some time off? Like, what happened once you retired?
No, that was when Ivy Tech Community College in Indiana, they had 14 regional campuses. And a good friend of mine, John Weikart, was a chancellor of the Bloomington campus, where I was stationed at the time. And he asked me to begin the criminal justice program at Ivy Tech in Bloomington, which I did, and which I enjoyed. But after less than 2 years, I really did miss the investigations. And so in late 2004, I became a licensed private investigator in the state of Indiana, working what I would thought was going to be primarily civil cases, because I did have a lot of fraud investigation experience. Catherine Lyle, attorney Kitty Lyle in Bloomington, asked me to get involved in a voter fraud case, which was not violent crime, of course. And I did so. And I was stunned about that case, because the state of Indiana brought charges against a man where there was no evidence. It was a rude awakening to what I had experienced before. And then after we successfully resolved that, the charges were dropped. Kitty asked me if I'd want to get involved in another case. And I thought, well sure, what do you got? And she said, David Kam. And I go, well, at least I'm thinking to myself, no way. Because as luck would have it, Dave's case was out of Floyd County. That's where I was born and raised, in New Albany, Floyd County, Indiana. And I thought, yeah, there's no way I'm going to get involved in this case. And as a strange twist of fate, the lead detective in Dave's case, the first investigation, was Sean Clemens, with whom I had been paired up in one of my last joint endeavors with the state police. And we had done accomplished a bunch of searches, arrests, and a major drug investigation in Floyd, Clark County, Jefferson County, Indiana. And he told me at the time that he was the case investigator on Dave's case, and was very proud of the fact that he had an instrumental role in convicting him. And I accepted that at face value. And I, at the time Dave's case actually was occurring, I was involved in a kidnapping, and we were sure a murder case of a IU co-ed, Indiana University co-ed, which unfortunately turned out to be accurate when her body was later found. But and so I had no reason to question the state's case or the fact that Dave was legitimately prosecuted and convicted.
You know, you hadn't done like a ton of cases. You said, okay, I'm going to start doing work. And then she convinces you, you know, to get on the David Kam case. And it's kind of interesting, because I think in the book, like the very first, in the prologue here, it's the dark side. And so you talk significantly in the book about the difficulties you had with trying to, you know, become David's investigator for the defense, and the fact that, you know, it was a difficult decision, maybe because of what other people were saying or what. So I'm just curious about, you know, your feelings on that or your thoughts. Oh,
sure. It was, and those weren't easily dissipated, far from it. And I did not commit to Kitty very easily. I wanted to do a little research myself. I did. I first read the Indiana Court of Appeals opinion, which said that unless there, without the character assassination, I'm paraphrasing, that occurred in Day's first trial, there was a good chance that he would have been acquitted. And that wasn't something I was prepared for. And I did a little more research, and I told Kitty, let me look a little bit more. And finally, I came to the conclusion that there was a decent chance that Dave was an innocent person. And so I got involved. But I told her, and I told Sam Lockhart, Dave's uncle, and I certainly told Dave when I met him, that I was going to search high and low for any information, evidence that would lead to him. We had a pretty easy mantra in the FBI, at least back in my day, and that was, let the evidence take you to your conclusion. It seems today in all walks of life that the narrative is more important than the evidence, than the true story. And I never wanted that to happen to me. And you have to be careful because of that, because people do and are biased and maybe reach conclusions too soon. And I wasn't going to reach a quick conclusion that David Kam was innocent. I wasn't going to do that. The evidence was going to have to convince me that he was.
Right. It's a difficult thing to do. And you mentioned Sam Lockhart, who was Dave's uncle. And I had the pleasure of meeting Sam as well. And that gentleman is an absolute rock, I would say an honest person. And I remember him telling me, he said that if my nephew is guilty, he says, I'll be the first one to, you know, I don't think he said flip the switch, but to paraphrase, you know, he was saying, I'll be the first one to lock him up and throw away the key if he did this, you know what I mean? So he was an honest person.
Sam is a person of incredible integrity and character.
Yeah, for sure. Can you, there's people who have heard bits and pieces about the David Kam case, but could you quickly summarize what happened on, it was a Thursday night, September 28, 2000, at the David Kam residence?
Sure. Dave, and I'll give you a little more background, a little more substance here. In March of 2000, Dave had quit the Indiana State Police as a road trooper. He'd been with them since 1989, a little over 10 years, and gone to work for Sam at a waterproofing and foundation stabilization business. And he was doing very well in the 6 months that he had worked there. On September 28th, which, as you suggest, was a Thursday, at a nearby church where Dave's uncle, Leland Lockhart, was a pastor, they had just finished a nice expansion, had a family community center with a large full court gym, and a lot of men would play basketball there that evening. They'd start about 7 and quit about 9. And that evening was no different. They normally wanted to have 5-on-5 full court, 10 players. And so the previous week they'd only had 8. So they've been calling around that earlier that afternoon, and at 7 o'clock, when they normally started, a minute prior to that, at 6:59, was when the alarm had been disengaged by Jeff Lockhart. That would be Dave's cousin. And then within 5 minutes or so, they had their 10 minimum players show up. About 7:15 or so, Sam Lockhart, who was the oldest at the time, 55, he showed up, and so they had 11 players. By the time Sam showed up, the 5-on-5 games were in progress, full court. And Sam's testimony has always been the same. He shot some hoops at the end of the court where they weren't playing. The game wasn't transitioning. about shortly after 8, the last game ended, and that's when he substituted for Dave. And the 5-on-5 games had continued during the time that Sam had been the standing as the 11th player. Well, shortly after 8 o'clock, another fellow came in, and it was a elder of the church, Tom Jolly. Tom, who I've gotten to know over the years and who interviewed and early on, Tom had finished working nearby a small farm of his and had driven to the gym and wanted to see how the gym was working out and came in when Dave was still playing basketball with the other 9. And then they transitioned, and by the time Dave did not play that game, he was on the sidelines, baseline, with Tom Jolly, and Dave and one of Tom's sons were close friends, so they talked about that. And then about 8:25, another player decided to leave. That was when Dave went back in. So now you've got 10 remaining players, and they're playing 5-on-5. At 9 o'clock, when they normally quit, some of the guys said, well, let's play some more. Well, 2 guys left at that time. So now you've got 8 players. And so then it was a 4-on-4 quick games. And they played for about 20 minutes. And the alarm was engaged at 9:22. So the time we got on one end is 6:59, 9:22 on the other. And during that entire time, David Cam was in that gym, as witnessed by so many people. At 9:22, Dave leaves the or exits the gym and drives about 3.5 miles to his home on Lockhart Road, which is, and this is important later, which is a dead-end gravel road in a semi-rural part of the county. He pulls into his to a shared driveway with his an aunt lives behind him with her husband and 8-year-old daughter Hannah. He pulls in the shared driveway and then pulls into his garage, which is just off Lockhart Road. As he lifts there's a 2-bay garage. As he lifts the right side, which is how he's going to get in, he sees on the floor there, on a concrete floor, a body. And he initially thought it was his daughter, Jill. Now, at that time, Kim, Dave's wife, 36 years of age, very smart, savvy lady, worked as a in finance at a large insurance company in Louisville, Kentucky, and they had 2 children, 7-year-old Brad and 5-year-old Jill. So Dave, the door comes up, and he sees his body in the darkened garage. The lights aren't on, and he races to it, and there's a huge pool of blood coming from what he then sees as Kim, his wife's head. And as an aside, I don't know if he notices at the time, but Kim is, she doesn't have on any shoes. Her shoes indeed are placed on top of the adjacent Bronco, Ford Bronco that she had driven. And she's without her pants. She had on a white pair of pants earlier that day. And she's also clad in black underwear, black panties, which didn't make an impression on anybody else except an arriving female trooper who immediately noticed that you're not going to wear black panties under white pants. But anyway, back to Dave's, at this time, he's obviously frantic. He's thinking about Brad and Jill, where are they? He jumps up and looks into the Bronco and is faced with just a horrific scene. 5-year-old Jill is still strapped in her seatbelt in the back seat behind the passenger front seat, and she's been shot in the head. He sees his son, who's behind the driver's seat, and Brad, he's draped over the back of the back bench seat in a manner that it's clear, and it would be to anyone, that he was trying to get away from the shooter. All 3, later it's determined, have been shot. Kim through and through the head, of the bullet actually hitting the interior of the windshield of the Bronco. Jill had been shot through and through the head And you could clearly see that path because of the downward path through the back seat after it exited her, the rear of her head. And then Brad, who was the only one not shot in the head, but he had no visible blood. And Dave thinks, well, in his mind, of course, you can only imagine how this man's mind is racing. He thinks maybe his son has a chance. So Dave enters the passenger side. It's a two-door Bronco. Enters the passenger side, goes through the two bench seats, over the console into the bench seat, grabs his son, embraces him, pulls him out, and lays him adjacent to the Bronco and starts performing CPR. And that, as we know, of course, was unsuccessful. Brad had actually been shot in the torso, had severed a spinal column, and probably not lived but a few minutes of that. And of course, Jill and Kim's injuries would have been instantaneously fatal. So then he runs into the house. The garage is detached, and there's a breezeway, an open porch, which connects the house to the garage. He runs into the house. They didn't keep their house locked. Runs into the kitchen, grabs a phone, and calls the Indiana State Police Sellersburg post, where he had been assigned for about 10 years. And then he runs over and across the gravel road is his uncle, Nelson Lockhart, 35-year police veteran of the Kentucky State Police in Jefferson County, Louisville, Police Department. And Nelson races back over with Dave. Nelson was with his 91-year-old father at the time, who was quite feeble. And Nelson sees what's happening, confirms that all three are dead, and then tells Dave, hey, we got to get out of here. This is a crime scene. So that's, yeah.
Yeah. That's the start of where police arrive, and there's all kinds of, the investigation starts and all this. And that's where everything kind of moves forward. So you, but you didn't get called into this until what point?
Well, no, at that time I was still with the FBI and would be for another 2.5 years. After the first trial, there were three motives, and this was consistent throughout, at least the latter two motives. But Stan Faith was the first prosecutor. Stan Faith had arrived on the at the crime scene within an hour or so of the state police, and he immediately made a decision to call a forensics expert, that blood expert with whom he had worked before. That was Rod Englert. And he did so the next day. And Rod Englert, as I recall, was teaching, and this would have been a Friday, and said he couldn't make it. But nonetheless, he would send his protege, a fellow by the name of Rob Stites. And so Rob Stites arrived the next day, which would have been Saturday, September 30th, 2000. And he immediately went to the Kentucky Medical Examiner's Office in Louisville, where the autopsies had been accomplished, and the victims were still there. And he did several measurements and took additional photographs. And then went to the crime scene, where he was given carte blanche access to everything. And then the next day, he went to the Sellersburg State Police Post, where he was given total access to the clothing worn by Dave. And Dave had voluntarily given up his clothing the night of, or at least early morning of, the murders. I should also mention at this time that Kim had a total of 22 bruises, contusions, lacerations on her body from her chin literally down to the tops of her feet. Both feet had been I think a good deduction would have been, well, they certainly were traumatized, but stomped on because there were small lacerations on the tops of each foot. So, and certainly one medical examiner, and she also had bruising to the elbows. it was a pretty clear indication that Kim had fought viciously with her attacker, including having one fingernail ripped off. Yeah,
and there's a couple of other important pieces there. And one is that Kim's shoes were neatly placed on top of this Bronco. It's just, it's, you can see, and she's a small lady. She's very short, and these things are up on top of the
Bronco. Yeah, Bronco's obviously a large vehicle. A lot of things are unexplained at the time. The fact that, well, first of all, the state police concluded early on that burglary had not been a motive because there had been no forced entry to the home, but yet the home wasn't locked. That was a tough one to. And then they claimed that there was no sexual attack on her, even though she was missing her her pants. And that how they concluded that, I think, was because they had reached another conclusion, and that they had concluded that Dave had been responsible for this, and that the sexual attack on Kim had been staged, quote unquote, and that there were other quick conclusions. Jill, on the Friday after the Thursday night murders, her autopsy had been conducted, and it became readily clear early on, just from a physical eyesight examination of the body, that she had some kind of trauma to her external, I should say, genitalia, but that was misclassified as injuries to her vagina, which was not accurate. And then in the probable cause affidavit, that was quote unquote consistent with sexual intercourse. That the medical examiner said that Jill had nonspecific blunt force trauma, and that's what it was. And it could have been that those injuries could have occurred through any number of reasons or sources. Later on, I think we concluded the most probable source, but there was no evidence that it was molestation, number one, and certainly no evidence whatsoever that those injuries, whatever they were, had been caused by her father. But nonetheless, that came out early, and that was one of the motives that Prosecutor Faith argued at the first trial. And then he had also argued that there was and indeed Kim had a sizable amount of insurance, but she was doing well financially, and the last insurance changes had occurred a couple months before, and she had been the one who implemented those changes. But most of all, on Dave, had lost a large $300,000 policy with the state police, a group policy. So Kim was the financial wizard. She knew what she was doing, and she was the one who had implemented all of these changes. And then the third motive that Faith argued was that Dave, who had engaged in affairs before, several years before, that he was wanted a free lifestyle, and therefore that was allowed. The first judge erroneously allowed him to bring in women with whom Dave had affairs before, and it was nothing more, nothing less than character assassination. A non-legal term, which I use, is he cheated, and the judge let him get away with it.
You had mentioned about Stan Faith calling in the bloodstain experts, and you know that on David's T-shirt, when you know he goes in and he pulls out, he's in a crime scene. It's got blood everywhere. So naturally, if he's moving around, he moves inside the Bronco. He pulls Brad out, brings him out to the garage floor. So naturally, he's going to have some blood on him. But it's determined that by the experts that there are several stains on the lower left part of his T-shirt that you know could have only come from what they're calling high velocity, you know, back spatter or whatever. So he had to be present when the gun was fired. How important was that evidence in the, you know, things tilting against David Kam's favor?
Well, let me give you a little backdrop on that first too, Eugene, because Rob Stites went and he examined this T-shirt on Sunday morning, October 1st. Before he went in there, he was told he thought by Prosecutor Faith that Dave was the shooter and or the suspect. And indeed, on his notes, he's got examination of suspect's t-shirt. So his mind has already been placed in you're going to be looking at a t-shirt which belonged to the shooter / suspect. That might have tainted some findings. At least I think it's certainly possible. But the t-shirt of David's, which, as you suggest, the lower left front in an area which was later designated as Area 30, he had 8 tiny stains, 4 of which were on the hem itself and 4 just on top of that. And within a matter of 15 minutes, and I've always thought this was unique, Stites found within 15 minutes that those were HVIS, high-velocity impact spatter, or blowback. And yet, in the subsequent years, there's been several hundred thousand dollars spent in examinations by at least 11 different experts. And that was, by the way, that turned out to be 5 said it was spatter, 5 said it was contact, 1 said it was spatter, then he said he didn't know. So, you know, we've got 50-50, literally a toss of the coin, as Stacy Uliana would say, and Stacy's one of the two appellate attorneys and one of Dave's defense attorneys in trials 2 and 3. So early on, he's told that this is a shooter suspect. And within 15 minutes, he says, oh, yeah, that's HVIS. Now, later on, now this is interesting, too. Later on that Sunday, one of the interviewing officers, Mickey Neal, state police detective, he's feeling a little not all that confident that in this expert's opinion. So he stops his part of the interview of David, interrogation, and goes and talks to Stites. He says, how sure are you? And Stites says, according to Neal, about 80%. And he says, 90%. And he goes, that's not good enough for me. So now then we have two disparate stories here. Stites says he calls Rodney Englert and describes to him over the phone, without Englert ever seeing these stains, what he had. And Englert said, yeah, that's what you got, HVIS. Englert later on says, no, that would never happen. I never would offer an opinion over the phone without seeing something. But nonetheless, Stites goes back in to Neal and says, I'm sure, I'm positive. So now we have, and Stites not only offered that opinion on the HVIS, but he said that the blood flow from Kim's head wound, that a cleaning solution was added to that, that the cleaning solution was then later thrown over the back deck. You could see the spots, and that a mop in the laundry room smelled of bleach, inferring that, well, that was the issue there, that they used a mop. It was never explained to me by anyone at any time why in the hell or what the purpose, if that ever happened, what good it would have done to add something to the blood flow. When I first saw it, I was pretty sure I knew what it was, but I wanted to verify that. And indeed, it was blood serum separation, which that was a forensic cause of looking at and saying, David Kam, according to the first probable affidavit, left the ball games and arrived home at 9:25. And that's when the first allegation was, the first affidavit, that's when he shot and killed his wife and kids. When, of course, blood serum doesn't separate in a matter of a few minutes. It takes a while, and certainly depending upon any number of other conditions. And that was well over an hour that it would have taken. It was then, and not only that, but the first lead detective had it all wrong. He said that Dave left about 9 o'clock. That was woefully wrong. And they had known. They had interviewed all the basketball players by that time. And where Detective Clemens got that information, I have no idea. And then he said that a neighbor heard at 9:15 3 sounds that could be interpreted as gunshots, i.e. that Dave had gotten home and that's when he killed the family. And that was totally wrong, too. And so then after Dave's arrest and after the Louisville area has been plastered with all this information about Dave Kim probably molesting his daughter and yada, 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 and all this assassination of characters occurred. Then it dawns on the prosecutor, this is not right. It didn't happen after the ball games. It happened during the ball games. Now what the hell are you going to do? So is the prosecutor going to say, press conference, I wanted to tell you that, we got it wrong. And if you do that, you're also going to say, there's a killer out there. Or what are you going to do? And that stay quiet, which is what they did. And very quietly changed the time of the murders as to the time that Dave was playing basketball with 11 other people, or with 10 other people. And actually, there were two spectators, one of whom died before the state police ever got to interviewing. But
I want to ask you about I think I may want to circle back on the investigation part and the interviews with the, because Dave's got 10, 11 alibis there, right? So, and what happened there, but there's another piece of evidence that was really important. And that was the sweater. There's this sweater that's at the crime scene.
Well, a sweatshirt. Yes.
A sweatshirt. And, on the inside back, it's somebody's written backbone. And right. That we've come to find out is the nickname or either given to him, or I think probably self-proclaimed nickname of Charles Bonnet. What I don't understand is, what took so long to get the sweater analyzed for DNA? I mean, this is, we're talking 2000. The DNA came back when?
Okay. The sweatshirt, gray sweatshirt, was on the floor other in the darkened garage. According to the chief evidence tech, it had, quote, gotten away from the state police and had actually been placed in the same body bag as had been Brad placed. And so it was recovered at the Kentucky Medical Examiner's office. It was indeed subjected to DNA analysis. And the state police lab in Evansville, Lynn Scamhorn did a very, very good job. Diane Tolliver did a wonderful job. The state firearms examiner, Ed Wessel, great job. The fingerprint examiner, John Singleton, all great, great work. They let the evidence do the talking. That didn't translate to other aspects of the investigation. But the sweatshirt, Lynn finds Kim's DNA on a sleeve, which would indicate that was part of the fight, and certainly the bloody fingernail. And there was unidentified female DNA also on the sweatshirt. Mike McDaniel, the first defense attorney, he sends a sweatshirt out to Orchid Cellmark, and they find, lo and behold, in that backbone hand imprinted name and the collar, they find some cellular DNA. And it comes back to unidentified male DNA. Well, Mike, thinking that, hey, this is a linchpin to the solution of this case, he asked Faith, the prosecutor, to run it through CODIS, the National DNA Database. And 2 weeks later, Faith says, I ran that DNA through the database. This is a couple months before the first trial. And he says, and there was no matches. And so, okay, so Mike goes to trial, and he tries to still bring up the sweatshirt as a possible garment left by the real killer. And he's ridiculed, of course, by Stan Faith. Fast forward in 2002, when he's convicted, 2004 in August, the convictions are overturned. And that's when Kitty Lyle and Stacy Uliana, and then later me, formed the defense team. And one of the first things we said, we've got to get this sweatshirt tested again, or at least the DNA try and match the unknown male and female, because there may have been some additions to the CODA database. Well, lo and behold, and of course, the second prosecutor, Keith Henderson, he was very, very slow in doing this. And finally, Kitty was forced to say, hey, if you don't do it, I'm going to get a court order. And so Henderson finally does it, but not until 2 weeks later after the results come back. is she notified, Kitty notified, and that's by a reporter who's been tipped off with a scoop by Henderson. Well, that the DNA comes back to Charles Darnell Bonet, who's an 11-time convicted felon, 10 convictions of crimes against women, violent crimes, attacking them at night. And this would fall under the category, I think, of a clue that he had the first five women he had attacked, he had tackled them, caused bruising at night near a car, and had stolen one item, a shoe. He was stealing shoes from these female victims as trophies. Well, recall the shoes on top of the Bronco. Some people may, you know, bring those two together. That didn't happen with the second investigation. Bonet had engaged in two armed robberies. Actually, there were three, two of which he had been charged, whereas women were again targeted, and he tried to abduct all of them. The last home invasion was an armed robbery of three IU, Indiana University co-eds, where after he had stolen their money and literally taken them around this condo, gun to the back of the head, holding their hair, threatening to blow their fucking brains out. Later he didn't get enough money. And all during this time, he's getting more and more in a frenzy, according to the three victims. And then finally takes him out to the car. He's going to take him to an ATM machine, where all three said, we knew we're going to be, it wasn't going to end well. Fortunately, a neighbor had seen some of this. Bloomington police officers, Matt Morris and George Conley, arrived, arrested Bonet at gunpoint. And so then he gets a 20-year sentence in 1992 for 1993 for his 1992 crimes. So he's supposed to be released in 2002. He gets out in June of 2000, 2 years before, 2 years early, after a letter-writing campaign to the sentencing judge, where he claims he's had exemplary behavior, and he's yada da da da, and he's also a born again Christian, and it worked, and so within a short period of time, he's in possession of a gun again, and anyway, so his identity and DNA is discovered in February 2005, and that's when the state police and the prosecutor's office say, well, my golly, he told us that he gave this sweatshirt to the Salvation Army, and you can't make this up, and it's not his fault that it fell into the hands of the wrong person. And this is, well, they actually went on TV and vouched for him, and this is after, you can't make this up either. This is after they gave him a stipulated polygraph, and he flunked it about his involvement in the crimes, and even a peak attention test about the murder weapon being a 380. And indeed, it was a 380 Larson semi-automatic. You can't make that up, but they said, no, we believe him. It's still David Kahn. That might fall under the category of blaring neon lights, confirmation bias.
Right. Now, you obviously you had interviewed Charles Bonet I don't remember the exact date, but, you know, sometime after that, you know, he's talking to the police, he's talking to the prosecution, and, you know, they're trying to get information from him. His story keeps changing. And I'll tell you what, like, when I watch videos of him, or I've seen some of the videos of him giving interviews and knowing his backstory, knowing some of the things he does, he's creepy to me. Like, he just comes across like even on video and stuff. I've never met him face to face, but he just gives me a bad feeling. And I'm wondering about your experience interviewing him, and, you know, what you were expecting, and maybe, you know, what struck you immediately in speaking to him.
Yeah, keep in mind, I've interviewed thousands of people over a total of a 40-year career. And certainly he wasn't the first one who fell into the category of what I deem as a true psychopath. Charles, it became clear to me, you know, we're talking about the horrific murders of a very protective mother and her 5 and 7 year old children who were assassinated in the back seat of the car. And I mean, it's about as horrific as it gets. And Charles Bonnet is playing games with me. It's obvious. And his concern is not about those horrific murders of the 5 or 7 year old child. It's about playing games, and he's playing games with me. And of course, he's a pathological liar. I mean, that's who they are, because the games they play, it's like, I'm smarter than you, and I'm going to show you just how smart I am. And within the first few minutes, it was obvious, and of course we knew, that Bonnet had repeatedly lied to me. He's trying to put his best face forward, but at the same time, he can't help but brag. For example, he's talking about what an exemplary prisoner he was in the Indiana Department of Corrections. And he said, well, you know, I really did good, and I helped mentor all these people, and yada-da-da-da, and they got their GEDs. And then he has to brag, and he says, we also did some other things, too. You know, we made hooch, we sold drugs, you know, and later on when we do get his DOC records, he's a soldier in one of the prison gangs, and he's out threatening to kill people. And it's clear to me, he has no conscience, he has no remorse about anything he's done. He says that he does, but he doesn't. But one thing I was able to get from him, and as at that time we were still having other DNA tested, blood fingerprints had not been compared, that had been lifted from the blood scene, including a huge palm print from the left hand on the passenger pillar post. And I asked him, I said, Charles, if any of that belongs to you, what would that mean? And I said, would it mean that you're at the scene? And he goes, well, yeah. I said, and if you're at the scene, that would mean that you were the shooter. Is that right? He goes, well, that would be obvious. And of course, he's confident at that time of the come that there's not going to be anything found there. But 4 days later and 4 days after, the prosecutors went on TV proclaiming his innocence and that he had been just a stooge in all of this. The palm print does come back from, and as well, you know, through your 3D animation, that palm print was that of Charles Darnell Bonnet, where a man who would be stabilizing himself reached into the back seat of that Bronco and cold-bloodedly shot to death a 5 and a 7 year old child. Yeah.
Have you ever seen a case where prosecutors and the police were, because there's no other way to say this, but they were helping him, they were coaching him, they were pushing him along to try and steer him to say certain things. Like if you listen to the interviews, and by the way, I have to say, like the in the book, there's a ton of details about the interviews, and I had never seen all of that beforehand. So getting access to that and being able to read it was very enlightening. But you know, in these interviews, you're like, why are they saying that? Like they're steering the guy. They're telling him what to say, basically.
Well, yeah, and see, they've got as one would say, a huge conundrum, because they've said all along that it's David Camp. Okay, now you got all this evidence. You got this man's very violent background, attacking women at night for their shoes, using a gun, pulling the hair. And by the way, one of the evidence techs said they had never seen so much hair on Kim as he had on her sweater, because it had been obviously pulled out. Well, that might be a clue too. Gun to the back of head, blow your fucking brains out. I mean, that could be a clue. And the fact also, he gave me 4 sets of alibi witnesses where he was that day, and starting at 2 o'clock. Well, now, if Kim and the kids weren't killed until we think around 7:50 to 8 o'clock that night, why is he starting his alibis at 2 in the afternoon? Well, a neighbor kid skipped school that day and saw a dark-colored Cadillac enter and then leave the dead-end Lockhart Road about 2 o'clock that afternoon. And it clearly was Charles Bonnet's vehicle. And there was a passenger in the vehicle with him. So he starts his interviews at 2 o'clock, or his alibis. at 2 o'clock. Well, that would be like, for most people, a clue also. And then he gives me three other alibis where he was that evening. And of course, I interview, and you can't make this up either, Eugene. This is just nutty. I interview all four of those alibis, and they said, well, that's bullshit. That didn't happen, including where he was at the time of the murders. Those alibis, even though they were not documented anywhere on any police report I'd ever seen, nonetheless, we knew that he had given them to him. So there's a lot of stuff which hadn't been documented. But yet, the investigators didn't contact any one of them, until well after he was arrested, and that was only after his palm print was found. So they did not want to know. It was one of these "don't confuse me with the facts" routine. It was pretty damn sad.
Yeah, when it comes to the investigators contacting people and running interviews and such like that, you had a little bit of an issue with the how they conducted the interviews of the alibis. Can you talk about that?
Well, one of the, if you're talking about Mala Singh, she was.
Sorry. I didn't mean those alibis. Sorry. I meant David Cam's alibis, the basketball players.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We sat down early on, Kitty and I sat down with each and every one of them. They keep in mind, they were not alibi witnesses until the time of the murders was changed from after the games until during. So they didn't know. Hell, Dave didn't know they were alibi witnesses. So what happens is that we sit down and talk with them, and every single one of them is like, why are we don't have anything to gain by lying. Some of them didn't even know Dave. And so you're going to say that, like Faith did, the first prosecutor, that these people were mistaken at best or liars at worst. How do you come up? It's they're only liars because you can't accept the fact that David Cam didn't kill his family. Yeah, it was insane. But nonetheless, at the first and second trials, those witnesses were they took the stand, told their story, and the questioning was, how many points did you score the second game? I don't remember. Who did you guard the third game? I don't remember. Did the second game last 13 or 19 minutes? I don't know. And it was like all and on. So they presented this case to the jury, these witnesses, as confused people. But how in that? Now think for a minute. If you've got 5-on-5 basketball players, how are you going to have one person leave the gym, leave the game, and not be missed? Well, that's what they said. Well, Dave Cam left and wasn't missed. It's like insane. But especially in the second trial, and I saw it up close and personal for damn near 9 weeks, Dave Cam, they were allowed to argue, and Henderson did, in final argument, that Dave had molested his daughter. There's no nexus whatsoever between her injuries and her dad. And they were allowed to cheat, and they did. And the jury said, well, hey, we were convinced that he molested his daughter. And so this highly inflammatory, emotional argument, it trumps the 11 eyewitnesses. And people say, and I said this when looking at this case. I said, that can't be. I said, come on now, you're telling me that 11 people said they were with him for all this time, and they're still going to convict him? Yeah, and that's what happened. And it really shows the gravity of emotion. And emotion ruled the day in the first two trials, very much.
Yeah. There was you mentioned Mala Singh before, and in your book you sort of point to it, an interesting theory that you have, that she was somehow involved. And I'm just wondering what kind of evidence or what kinds of things did you hear that, you know, made you think that, hey, she might have been there?
Well, keep in mind there was unidentified female DNA. Bonet tells the investigators, and he tells me that, well, you know, it's certainly possible that unidentified, and he knew this case forward and backwards, and probably had attended some days of the trial. We knew he was in the courthouse during Dave's trial, the first trial. So that would be an indication to me, yet again, of a personality that was very proud of the fact that he got away with this. But he tells me, he says, so did you ever consider that that unknown unidentified female DNA might have been belonged to the one who helped the killer who was involved in this? So that, and that, that was, that's yet another aspect of him playing games. I quite frankly, I use a crasser term. I call these people fuckwits because they like to fuck with you at thinking that they were brighter. But so he did that not only with me, but with the police investigators. And then, among other things, keep in mind, there was the witness who saw the outline of a passenger in the vehicle. We know that Mala was living with Bonet at the time. Her own words place her with him that day, that night. And her DNA is indeed discovered, matched finally, as on the same sweatshirt that's got the DNA of her boyfriend and Kim's DNA. So we've got some pretty good evidence there that, that all of that was placed there at the same time. And Mala Singh's, she even says in an initial interview that she knew that Charles Bonet had seen Kim and the kids at a store. The inference was at a store, but that as he had known of them. And indeed, his residence where he lived with his mother and with Mala was within a few hundred feet of a meat market where Kim's sister had owned and operated with her husband. And Kim had gone there very frequently, also a supermarket nearby. So Mala admits at that time, then she later backtracks and claims she never said that. But she also makes a comment during a interview with the investigators that I did see the killings. And it's like, well, they didn't follow up on that. That's would be like a clue too, you know. They didn't follow up on that. And they were giving her, they told her, hey, all we were trying to do is eliminate you, you know. And just like they told Bonet, hey, we need the connection between you and David. And what's Bonet supposed to say? There is no connection, because which there wasn't. And by the way, there was no evidence whatsoever. Cellular phones, records, witnesses, nothing. Among other things, Bonet, when he finally decides to say that, oh, yeah, that he had given a gun to Dave and sold it to him, and he didn't know it was going to be used in the murders. You know, I'm a big victim here. One thing he did say that, well, I first met David playing basketball with 16 to 18 other people at a community park in New Albany. Well, you would think 16 to 18 others, basketball, and this is the biggest crime story, I think, the so far certainly of the 21st century in the Louisville area, that you would think that at least one witness would come forward and say, oh, yeah, I was playing in that game or I saw them. There was no witnesses. And once again, there's no corroboration whatsoever to any of Bonet's stories. But back to your question as to Mala's involvement, her interviews are replete with information. I think a decent interrogation would have revealed that she was with him that night. And she says that he later comes home that night. He's bruised. He's out of breath. He's got a gun. He threatens to kill her. Threatened to blow her brains out. Well, that's consistent, of course, with what he had done before. But yet she didn't know anything about it. I got to tell you here. Here are the quotes during Bonet's interviews. And I'm not going to say interrogations. He was arrested, but it wasn't an interrogation over 3 or 4 days. It was a tutorial, at least in my assessment. Here's Wayne Kessinger, one of the prosecutor's investigators. He tells Bonet, this is after Bonet tells him of what happened that night, and how he got to the Cam house and gave him the gun. Kessinger says, quote, your whole story is screwed up. There's nothing about that story that's believable. How many times are we going to sit and listen to you concoct this story that meets your needs, end quote. And then Gary Gilbert says, you don't have your time straight. There's absolutely no way that David could have met with you at the store. You follow him and everything else within the time frame. You do know that his alibi that he's using, don't you? He says, all this is bullshit you're talking about, end quote. And then another investigator, Myron Wilkerson, state police, he says, David Camp does have an alibi. Do you understand? He really does, and that's going to be a problem. He has an alibi that is not matching up with what you're saying. If you're not careful, you're going to be a better witness for him than against him. So that's what they have, and that's what they have at the end of it. And based upon nothing, bullshit, and as one said, a crock of shit, what Henderson later does, a second prosecutor, he charges a conspiracy count between Bonet and Dave. And the conspiracy is that Dave hired Bonet to kill his family. And it's just out of whole cloth.
Yeah, it's crazy because everything about the crime fits Bonet. It fits his character. It fits his past crimes, everything about it. And so instead of saying, hey, we got the guy, you know, let's celebrate. We got somebody off the streets that is going to potentially do this again. They try to kill two birds with one stone, so to speak, because they don't want to be proven wrong about David Camp, because then there's going to be some. Yeah, yeah. It brings up an interesting point, though, about the justice system and the fact that prosecutors and things like that, you know, there need to be they're right all the time. And, you know, what they say goes, as opposed to I think what their job should be is really truth finding. You know, it's really about, hey, let's look at the facts. Is there, is there a reasonable amount of evidence to, you know, charge somebody with a crime? And then, you know, then we'll take them to court and let the jury decide. But they tried very hard to prove David guilty no matter what. And some of this, like you're saying, is just crazy stuff. And I've never seen a case so fraught with issues like this before. So, and it seems to me in reading the book that there was clearly tension, obviously, between the prosecution and the defense, but almost to the point where it was malicious, where you know, they wouldn't be contacted on important evidence, you know, like you said before, when they find out about DNA and things like that. Henderson goes to the news before he goes and calls the defense about certain things. And was there a lot of this stuff going on?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And there certainly is. I'm confident. Information of which we don't know and will never know. Among other things, we were kept in the dark, and this doesn't come out until the part two, but I'll tell it to you now, is that Kim and Brad and Joe were buried in Graceland Cemetery in New Albany, a beautiful cemetery, and it's a corner lot, large stone. Well, after Bonet is identified, they actually do put a GPS device on his vehicle. And this vehicle is tracked into Graceland Cemetery. On the day that Bonet goes into this cemetery, and it's not only tracked there, but Dave had been out on bond uniquely for a period of a few weeks in late January to the time of his second arrest in March of 2005. The investigators have placed a video device and audio device on or near the stone with the belief that, well, Dave may go there the first time he's been allowed to see, visit his family's grave site, and he would go there perhaps to apologize or to talk or what have you. And not a bad piece of investigation. But on the day that, and Dave doesn't go there, by the way, he's still, I don't know if he's ever properly grieved for the loss of his, he was, of course, arrested before the funerals of his family. But the day that Bonet is tracked there on his GPS device, you'd want to say, well, did he go to the gravesite? And what did he say? Well, wouldn't you know it, the audio and the video had failed that day. The only time it had failed. You can't make this stuff up.
I get it. I remember speaking to you before, and I remember hearing this story, and that was one of the ones that I was just absolutely amazed at. But what a coincidence, huh?
Well, one thing I want to mention too about Mr. Stites, he also had deduced that there was probable blowback on the overhead garage door above where Kim had been shot, and he had the state police disassemble the garage door and kept as evidence. Later on, there was a chemical test conducted out of that, and it was oil-based, which meant that, he later acknowledges that, well, he thought that the blowback came from Kim Cam's head. Actually, the blood on the lower left of the T-shirt came from Jill Cam, and rather easily explained, was when Dave went into the car through the between the two bucket seats, placed his left knee on the bench seat and grabbed his son. And that was when Jill's head, and certainly where her head was when it when she was shot, was still upright when Dave had seen her. But then it tilted over to the left once the depression in the seat, and her hair was still bloody, and the blood came from the bloody ends of her hair. So
yeah, I remember quite extensively doing a lot of the work on that and trying to reconstruct those events and trying to figure out like what may have happened or whatever. In preparation for the third trial. And right. So that was quite interesting. And some of the experts that we were dealing with too. So I think people listening to this can see that the amount of information and detail there is in this case, it's necessary to have not just one book. Otherwise the book would be, you know, really thick. And so you're definitely working on the second one. When do you expect the second one to be approximately done?
Yeah. September of 2023. And one thing I didn't want to be accused of, Eugene, I wanted the story to be told. I want it to be detailed, accurate, honest, and for people to see it. Some people are never, ever going to be convinced of Dave's innocence. But nonetheless, people with an open mind hopefully will read this, will be amazed. And unfortunately, I think several people will be shocked.
And how far are you going to go in the second book? Like, how far is it going to cover?
Well, it's going to cover up until this year. Because earlier this year, Dave, as you may recall, was successful civilly in suing the state of Indiana. It's my understanding that his suit against the two bloodstain people, Rod Englert and Rob Stites, had been settled. I believe there's a non-disclosure agreement in that regard. And earlier, a few years back, Dave had settled with the county of Floyd County because there was three entities that were being sued, and so all of those have been resolved.
Excellent.
And but yet they're the state of Indiana. They deserve scrutiny too in this, and we're going to give them that.
Okay. I want to show people the website here, and I want to bring that up because they may be interested in looking at this more closely. So it's www.theirbloodylies.com, and this is where they can order the book through, correct?
Yeah, you can actually just davidcam.com, and that'll in your search engine, and that should jump you up there to that. And it gives you some video, gives you a snippet of my video with Charles Bonet, also with the prosecutors after Bonet has been identified. You also have, I've included another chapter 5, which articulates the evidence such as it was, which caused the arrest of David within 3 days of this horrific crime.
Yeah, actually, under the on the inside look, when you go to that page where it says the discovery, there's a little audio file here. It says Dave's state police call. Listen to that call, and it's really interesting because and somebody had mentioned this to me, and they said when you listen to Dave on that call, it's very difficult to hear a person who's trying to fake it. It sounds as about as a it's an authentic call. A person is extremely distressed, and you know, people can go there and they can listen to them themselves and make their own mind up. Gary, so if somebody wants to contact you, I can see here there's a let's see, is there an email? Oh, there's something down here. So yeah, it says cambloodylies@gmail.com. So people can reach you through there. I may have lost him. Let me see here. Oh, he's flipped and he's frozen. So I don't know if he's still there. Maybe he'll bounce back in a second. But anyway, I'm pretty sure that they can reach you. I believe I've asked him before here where it says cambloodylies@gmail.com. I believe you can get, access to, Gary that way. And so, yeah, unfortunately he's dropped off and that hasn't happened very much, but let me say a big thank you to Gary. If he's, hopefully he'll pop back on here in a second, but if not, I want to say thank you to him. He's done a great job here on the book. A lot of good detail here. If you're interested in the David Kam case, definitely pick it up, have a look. And folks, I want to thank you. And so have a wonderful holidays, and we'll see you in 2023. Thank you very much, everyone. Bye-bye.